You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
Folks, this is Jennifer Knapp. Well, having just released her first album since 2001 called Letting Go, Jennifer simultaneously came out, and that's been the discussion amongst many people. And boy, it's fascinating to go online and watch people talk about this or blog about this. And it must be just a bizarre feeling for Jennifer having these discussions going on about her. So instead of having a discussion about her, we thought we would have a discussion with her. After a seven-year sabbatical from a Grammy-nominated career, Jennifer Knapp returned to music industry. And, boy, that return has thrilled some, angered others, confused many who are trying to reconcile how one of Christian music's biggest names could possibly be in a same-gender relationship. For many people, that's just like, what? Excuse me? So having said all that, I want it to be known right off the bat that Jennifer Knapp is so much more than this one issue. And if you've heard me talk about this sort of stuff on our show, you know how sick and tired I am of the Jesus people only being known as a two-trick pony, right? Abortion and gays, please people, there's so much more to talk about. And so we'll do that right now with Jennifer Knapp. Hi, Jennifer.
Hey, how you going?
How you going? Are you going to start off with the Aussie stuff right away? Golly.
Oh, sorry.
Listen, the first thing I got to know right off the bat is, I want to know about the tat on the right shoulder, right on the deltoid there. Tell me about that.
Well, it was the first tattoo I ever actually got, and that caused quite a controversy at the time.
Really?
But, yeah, it really did.
Gee.
Yeah, that's what I might have known. I was in a little bit of trouble. But or everyone else was knowing that I was in a little bit of trouble. But it's a halo of thorns. It's like a little circle halo of thorns kind of thing.
Okay. All right. How about the one inside the left arm by the elbow?
Those are 2 7-point stars. Symbolizing my Aussie citizenship.
Well done. Well done. Were you living in a suburb of Sydney? Because you were down there for a good chunk of change. Suburb of Sydney or way out in Whoop Whoop?
No, I was actually on the North Shore is what they call it. I was in a little suburb called Lanco. You could stand on my roof and see the Centre Point and the Opera House and the bridge. It's beautiful.
Wow, one of my favorite areas. I spent 5 years in Australia. I was up in the Blue Mountains.
Oh, lovely.
And my favorite place to go to was the basement. Did you get there many times?
Yeah, actually. I saw a few shows there, and I ended up starting to avoid it because it was making me so jealous of my hiatus.
I can imagine. You know, the basement was, that's where I first met Tommy Emmanuel. He and I have since become, you know, fairly decent acquaintances, and boy, what a freak show he is. Have you gone to one of his gigs?
I've never seen him in live, but I actually recently—I think he's in and out of Nashville a fair bit. And one of my Aussie friends recognized him in the airport the other day. I'm like, "Who's Tommy Emmanuel?" I had no idea. And it just so happened, like a couple weeks ago, I saw a performance of his. I think it was on PBS or something here in the States, and it was just so unreal. I just had my jaw on the floor the whole time watching it. It was just—he's an amazing performer. On top of the fact that he's an amazing guitar player, it's unreal.
Yeah, I think the term gobsmacked was invented for him.
I think so, yes, indeed. I think about that point, I was considering sawing my guitars in half and just giving up the whole thing.
I know. He does that to a lot of people. Do you spend much time down at the Rocks? Did you get down there? My favorite pizza joint in the whole world is down in the Rocks.
Well, I do go down to the Rocks. I did go down to the Rocks fair, but they had Sunday markets there and a lot of artisans that put up. And there's just always kind of something going on every weekend. So I was down there quite a bit. It was a pretty easy ferry ride for me to just get over on a Sunday afternoon. And, yeah, I'd go to hang out in the Rocks. There's a really great modern art museum there. ride at Circular Quay. And, of course, I was always going to the zoo because it's just a beautiful place to go and hang out. And, yeah, so I got around a fair bit.
Did you climb the coat hanger?
I never did. No, my partner is afraid of it. Other than going by myself, which, you know, wasn't a bonus, so it wasn't a lot of motivation to look like a nerd in one of those little, like, coverall suits they put you in. But my mom came down to visit, and I tried to talk her into going, but nobody was brave enough to go up with me.
Bummer. Bummer. What was your favorite beach?
You know, I'm not a big beach girl.
Oh, are you kidding me?
I'm not a big beach girl, but I can't remember the name of the beach.
You should have moved to Toronto then instead of Sydney.
But Balmoral Beach is a really quiet beach.
Yeah.
Kind of like a little cove and good fish and chips to hang out there and good food and just a good relaxing afternoon and not a lot of surf. But, yeah, I tried to surf there for a while and tried to bodyboard for a while until I got dumped on my head into the sand underneath the water, and I was like, that's stupid.
That's stupid.
So, I appreciate the skill and the talent of the many water surfing amazing people there, but I am a land lover.
Got it.
In the day.
My favorite luthier is still actually in the Sydney area on Parramatta Road. This guy worked. He's a genius on my guitar. I've got a 74 Jumbo Guild, and but I know you're playing Taylor a lot. What series are you playing these days?
My go-to has been an 810 for years. It's just a big dreadnought. I have a 96 810 that I've since retired from being on the road, and I just picked up a new one, but that's really my go-to. Because I do a lot of solo acoustic work, I end up having to retire. I had a couple of grand auditoriums through the day, like the 814 series and a couple of different wood combinations, but at the end of the day, I'm a spruce top, rosewood back kind of gal.
Wow, that's the best kind of gal, I'm telling you. But I think most people don't realize this. Jennifer Knapp only picked up the guitar in your senior year of high school, I think. Is that about right? Is it just something to add to your repertoire?
Yeah, I was actually going to school as a music education major and had spent a good portion of my high school, the last couple of my high school years, just really trying to expand my musical instrumentation. Because once you get to college, you're required at some point to have, like, at least a rudimentary ability to play all the instruments that you're going to teach. Mm. And so I was going through that round, and on my way out of high school, I realized that I had no concept of what string instruments did or what, you know, how that was going to happen. And I knew going into college I was probably going to be required to at least pick up the violin for a little while. And so I was intimidated by that, and I thought, well, a lot less intimidating would be a guitar. So I went out to my local flea market and bought my first guitar, which was actually a classical guitar, which is meant to be strung with, you know, cat gut strings or soft strings. And it was actually, and I didn't know it at the time, I had no clue about it, but it was this really broad neck, and it was supposed to be strung with cat gut strings, and it had steel strings on it. I had no idea. It was warped, and I don't know, but it was my first guitar, and for some reason I started, you know, I didn't know what to do or how to play it, but I just went and got a book and started playing some really easy songs from artists like Cowboy Junkies and Tracy Chapman, and started writing my own and integrating my poetry that I'd been writing for years on top of the songwriting thing. So it turned out to be rather serendipitous, but I didn't really have a desire to do it, but...
Well, can I just say, as someone who has learned to appreciate who you are, what you do, I'm not a big Jesus music fan, and really, I got to admit this right at the top of this interview, I didn't know much about you, and you didn't know much about me, and now here we are, and it's a beautiful moment. But I've really come to appreciate your stuff, and I'm just so glad that you decided to give up the trumpet that you used to howl on in the school band.
Well, it's the Q-tip marching band hat that kind of did it in for me.
Oh, no. You know what it did? I think it was the Breakfast Club Molly Ringwald 80s pseudo-risky business sunglasses you used to wear.
Oh, my gosh. Have you seen that photo?
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Lovely.
Yeah. That was just scary. I'm just saying. So, all right. Let's do a little chronological thing here. You got a messy story, and that's the reason I really wanted you on my show. The squeaky clean people drive me nuts. But your mom was 17, your dad was 24, just out of Vietnam kind of deal, and they had a fling. Your mom got knocked up with you and your twin sister, and so they figured you should get married, right? They figured they should get married, so they did that.
Pretty Midwestern feel, yeah.
Yeah. So for whatever reason, marriage doesn't work out between them, but you and Sis ended up living with your father out on the farm, right?
Yeah, it was actually like a bit of a landmark case in Kansas, where I was my sister and I were one of the first custody cases that didn't actually go full-time custody to the mother.
Yeah.
So it was a very traumatic experience. I think I was very young through this whole process, so I basically never lived with my mother growing up. And but you know, since that time, obviously, I've built a relationship with her and had a lot, you know, visitation and all of that, those kinds of things. But yeah, it was a really interesting and different kind of upbringing compared to most of the people around me.
So why did the courts give you to dad instead of mom? Or what was the goal behind that?
I mean, without going too far into it, it's basically, you know, she was fairly young and there was a big kind of push between the custody battle of the two parents, and my father just won out, being about 7 years older and having a stable job and an education.
Oh, okay. All right.
There's a bit of a push toward that kind of attitude.
Yeah. Do you remember your parents playing you at all in the divorce? Like, who do you love more kind of stuff?
Oh, I don't think my parents necessarily played me, but, I mean, there's definitely that tension, like, whether or not, like, my parents ever meant to do it. I think as a kid growing up trying to please both of them and loving them and recognizing each of them having a quality that I need and that...
Right.
An attitude that I require as a child, and having them split up in different parts, it was really difficult growing up, and I felt that tension pretty much my entire, you know, childhood and living in those households. And it's taken me years as growing up as an adult to go, well, you know, you can't please everybody all the time, but as you become an adult, you can start to invest in those relationships as an individual, I think, a little bit less dependent as I was as a child.
So your dad got remarried when you were, what, like five, I think, right? So what was life like with your dad and his new wife?
Yeah, it was interesting. it was definitely racked with tension. I mean, there was a fair bit of emotional abuse going on in my household that I had to learn to kind of navigate my way through. So it was very difficult.
Yeah, well, have you been able to forgive him for those cutting words, you know, you're just like your mother, you're going to turn out just like your mother. No praise at all, really?
I think it took me a long time. I think, you know, when you're becoming an adult and trying to figure out what your own self-value is and your own self-worth, I mean, I was very fortunate. I was a very good student, and I had I was participating in music, and that was when I started to gravitate and hold on to those things and have something that I could hold on to that reminded me that I was a person of value and worth, no matter what they meant out in the external world, but they mattered to me. And I think when I started to recognize those things was starting probably about a 10-year battle of getting to the point where I believed in myself as a human being, no matter what I was, no matter what I'd been through, no matter what anybody ever said to me, that I was capable and worthy of being loved and building up quality relationships. And you know, it took a fair bit of alcohol and a fair bit of, like, you know, just college experimental kind of just throwing yourself at everything and seeing just how far you can abuse yourself. But, I mean, I think it was at the point where I think one of the reasons why I ended up gravitating to Christianity was the very tenet that I was really drawn to, that Christ said that we matter. Period. Regardless of who you were. And there were so many parables at that time when I started to hear about those in college that really started to make me take note and take stock of the things that I believed about myself that had never had anyone externally telling me.
You know, with the research that I've done and just looking into your life and, I mean, it sounds a little... trite for me to say I'm really sorry for the crap you had to grow up with, because I don't know you at all, but I still feel really crap for the kind of stuff you had to grow up with. But your sister eventually couldn't take it anymore, so she split and went to live with your mom, right? I mean, you left the womb before her, like 18 minutes, but she left the house before you, so why is that?
Okay, dude, your research is, like, really close to stalker. This is amazing. Is that your producer laughing at you?
Yeah. Yeah, speaking of stalkers.
Yes, it was my twin sister, and I think we were about 12 or 13, and at that point within the legal system in the United States, you have an opportunity to choose or have a heavyweight in speaking for which parent you want to live with. And at that time, my sister decided that she wanted to go live with my mother. And so the one stable thing that had been in my life my entire time that, you know, I could kind of trust with on my own peer level, or when things were bad, we could kind of like go out to the barn and set stuff on fire together or whatever we needed to do.
Hey, I used to do that too. Sorry.
So, I mean, it was really, I don't think I appreciated how traumatic it was at the time, but as I kind of grew up, it was, you know, as I kind of moved on from there, I realized how incredibly just stressful my home life was, and that it was so bad that my sister had to leave for some unknown, that anything was better than where she was at.
Yeah.
And I couldn't understand that. And at the same time, my personality just wouldn't let me to be defeated. Hmm. There was some part of me that I felt like I couldn't leave, and that I couldn't devalue my father, whom I loved and adored, by just simply leaving. And that's not to be a criticism of my sister. I think she did an amazing thing, and I've spent many years jealous of her courage to be able to do that.
All right, so you get to the point where you're looking for purpose and meaning and self-worth, and you start reading books on Buddhism and Hinduism, witchcraft. But why wasn't Christianity an option for you? I mean, heck, your grandma, I mean, she used to drag you out to church every Sunday, so why didn't you buy into that boat?
Mostly it was because of the pantyhose.
Hold on, because you just gave me a nasty visual of grandmother's pantyhose, which are the scariest things on the planet. But are you talking about pantyhose in general at church?
She required me. I remember my grandmother and both my grandparents on my father's side were very, you know, every Sunday they were in church. And we actually ended up spending a lot of time growing up with them on the weekends, and they would drag us to church every Sunday morning. And my grandmother would put this poor old tomboy in a dress and pantyhose and terrible patent leather shoes and drag me off to church. And I really appreciated, you know, I started to be involved in a little of church through my high school years, and because of a lot of my community involvement with music, and ended up playing in a lot of churches. And I started to entertain that. I mean, it wasn't just the pantyhose and patent leather shoes, and I started to meet some really incredible people in there, and I think some people that were really busting the mold of what I always thought Christianity was supposedly, you know, this puritanical, pious kind of people that couldn't get beyond loving anyone different than, you know, less than the holy person that they imagined that you needed to be.
Oh, you mean the people that comment on your YouTube videos these days? Those people?
Well, yeah, it's there.
All right, well, just to concisely go through this journey, though, you turned your back on God. You did the typical off-the-college party, your face-off thing. Well, I don't know how typical it is to blow about $2,000 on booze in the first 2 months of college, but good for you. And then you found some people whose lives you admired and found out they were Jesus people. And then 2 months into your freshman year, at 2 a.m., you turn your face towards the Creator and go, okay, let's do this. Right? Is that about it?
Yeah, it's pretty close. It was an Aldi's parking lot, a grocery store parking lot, actually. And I don't know. Yeah, I had a lot of friends, like, starting to give me Bible verses, and they were really cool people. I mean, I had some really dear friends in college, and some that were just on me because that was their mission, to save, like, the worst harlot on the dorm floor. Let's take the worst one, and we'll find her. And I seemed to be surrounded by people who were trying to lead me to Christ. And so it was a little bit weird, but, I mean, as I started to kind of, like, venture out and read some of the scripture that people were giving me and going, okay, what are these people really about? And what is this whole Christianity thing really about? And, I think I got it in snippets, and just starting to understand and reading the Gospels really made a lot of sense to me that like I was speaking before, in particular, like the parables that just talk so much about Christ's inclusivity of just the most wounded of souls. And I was, you know, I kind of almost went in on a dare, both just the exhaustion of the people making a missionary work out of me and just a dare to see if the gospel could ring true in my life.
Well, of course, flash forward, next thing you know, you're making it big in the Jesus music scene, and then the next thing you know, you're leaving the Jesus music scene to take off to, well, Australia, I guess, right? I mean, let me try to figure out why you split, all right? It's either A, you just got sick and tired of people calling you the Christian Alanis Morissette, or B, you were ticked that you didn't actually win the Grammy you were nominated for, or C, it was all just too much carrying a really heavy schedule, like 3 major label releases inside of 4 years and 150 to 200 dates a year.
Yeah, it was a lot of that. I vote C.
Okay.
It was a lot of that. I mean, I was truly exhausted. And in a matter of about 4 years or so, I really just had very little time to refuel in that process. And by the time I got to my third record, basically on my third record, while I wrote it in like hockey dressing rooms across the country and was really slogging it out, I didn't enjoy the process at all. And there was a lot there that I really wanted to get into. But I kind of like went into my third record with half of these songs, and we got a producer that I think he did a fine job with the record. I don't mean to criticize it, but at the end of the day, my touring schedule, I basically sang on the record. And a lot of half bits and half pieces of songs were pieced back together by a producer that I wasn't even involved with the whole process. And parts that I was really looking forward to in the art, just like we had the London Symphony Orchestra play strings for the record, and so I was really hoping to go over to London and be involved with the composition and part of that project, because these are the things that kind of do keep you going. You have to kind of, the work is work, and I'm not complaining about work. I love it. I love hard work, and I love being exhausted at having done something that's really important. But you also need the treats and the nuggets of that really inspire you and keep you going. And I realized that I was missing all of those entirely. And then to add one more insult to injury, I just found myself growing a little bit more liberal than my environment was labeling me as. And, you know, just like women coming up to me and my sexuality aside, because I was celibate this whole time. I just put it on the back shelf because I couldn't even deal with whatever I might or might not be. There were people coming up to me saying things to me about what their music had saved them from that were endorsements that I would have never, you know, required of anyone to approach the gospel. And, you know, women coming up to me going, oh, your music has saved me from a life of homosexuality, or your music has, I think, you know, if that's where you want to go, I don't mean to criticize that at all. But there was a certain point where I realized that I was growing at a rate that was kind of testing the boundaries of what my public image was perceiving to endorse. It was becoming really frustrating, and I felt like I needed to step off rather than become angry or become argumentative. I really wanted to be in a peaceful place about what I was doing, and I didn't know if that meant that I could be a musician or not anymore, so it was really a confusing time as well.
Jennifer, you talk about you going off the grid in Oz, and I've heard you say that there's no correlation, or maybe not that there was no correlation, but it wasn't the main reason for you going AWOL in Oz. The fact that, you know, you were around that same time entering into what has now been an 8-year relationship with this gal who shall remain nameless. Was there a correlation between you taking off and going, okay, I'm falling in love with this girl and this doesn't match the scene I'm in?
I decided to leave before that, and I had about another year of dates on the books that I was basically just trying to get through. I was just trying to knock them off, and no offense to those shows.
I was at that concert.
Well, yeah, I've heard some fair amount of criticism about my attitude at that time. But, you know, it was in that last year that I really started to kind of, like, start to assess the people that I cared about and why and how, and realize that I had not made room for any friendships at all in my life. And as I kind of started to engage in particular friendships that I had, and my partner being one of them, I started to realize why I hadn't perhaps done that, because it was too risky. It was too risky to fall in love with anybody. I found criticism from male relationships that I had that were, you know, not sexual, and I'd, you know, oh, you're just sleeping with this person, you know, you should avoid the appearance of evil. you can't be too close to this male, you can't be close to this female, because, you know, all the criticism that I usually felt with building up any of those relationships always kind of got dug into this trundle of sex, you know, just like this bad sexual energy. And it wasn't until I just started to say, listen, I just can't do this anymore. I need friends. I need friends, good friends, and I need friends to help me out through this and to just start building relationships. And so my partner happened to be one of those people. And so I think, you know, when I'm looking at that going, yeah, it was kind of like the straw or the needle, the straw that broke the camel's back. I'm like, oh, whoa, hold on a second.
Yeah.
I really do have feelings for this person. And, yeah, there's if I had any shred of doubt that I needed to go and reassess and see what was going to come out of all this, I needed to step back. That was a good reason as any.
I watched your Larry King interview last night. First of all, let me just apologize for Buddy, who actually said, it's Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. Are you kidding me? I mean, sir, I don't know the guy from a bar of soap. He seems gentle and meek and mild, and I've seen people like, you know, guys like Mark Driscoll who come across even angrier than this guy. But seriously, that's what you came out with on national television? The Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve? So I'm very sorry you had to endure that.
Well, I think it's, you know, I had to try not to laugh at that point. I mean, and it's a little easy to laugh at that statement because it's just, it's so overused. And but I think it's a symptom of the conversation or the lack of conversation or the lack of preparation that we've had to have this conversation within the church that goes beyond the trite little sayings. With any conversation or any debate or any, you know, dialogue that any person hopes to have, no matter the topic, if it's difficult, it's very hard to listen. And I think those are indicators that, rather than being offended by that, I think they're indicators of the lack of preparation or the lack of experience, probably, in having a conversation like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I cringe. I think back to my days of being on pastoral staff at that church in the Blue Mountains up in Glenbrook, and I still got all the tapes in a box of all the messages I ever did, and I pulled them out a while ago and listened to a few of them, and I just almost vomited because I think I came out with that kind of stuff, and I just, oh, I want to apologize publicly right now for all the dumb, stupid things I've said. So here's the deal. Here's I got to admit my awkwardness here, right? Like, I've had a lot of people on the show. We've talked about the gay issue lots on this show. A few weeks ago, I had two gay guys in here. One was convicted that the Bible says that he should be celibate, and the other gay gentleman is not convicted that way. And so we kind of had an open dialogue about this whole conversation. And I'm still this straight, you know, hetero guy who I just don't get a lot of it. And I've got a good friend named Wendy Gritter who heads up this ministry called New Direction for Life, New Direction Ministries. And she's always slapping me upside the head because of my terminology, my insensitivity. Oh, it's brutal. Like, seriously, I'm not real good with this. But here's the deal. I'm not even sure there's a God. Right? That's the headspace I'm in these days.
Yeah.
So I'm not the best person to stand on the soapbox and condemn you for whatever. But I am sitting here openly admitting that I just haven't reconciled this whole thing. So for all those people out there, right, I'm giving you a platform right now, Jennifer Knapp, to all those people, a platform to say to, you know, whatever the heck you want to say to all the Jesus people who've turned on you, or maybe they haven't turned on you, but they just don't get it. Like there's a guy who commented on one of your YouTube videos. He says, I'm not happy that you came out, though I wasn't surprised. I don't get that. Anyway, I'll still listen to your music. We all struggle, but he overcomes. What do you say to me and all the other schmucks out there that don't get it?
Well, To be honest, everyone asks me, you know, have you reconciled your faith and your Christianity? And, I don't know that I have a resolution as far as, you know, a solution or a finite answer.
Right.
I don't know that I ever will, although I'm a seeking person, I think, in my mentality, and I'm constantly kind of going over what I hope to accomplish or what I hope to be, or I have better understanding of that. But that being said, I think it's a larger issue for me rather than just my sexuality and my faith.
Yeah.
what I found in the last 15 years or so of 10 years or so or whatever it is of my being a Christian, I finally got to a point where I was just frustrated. I was at a show one day and I was talking and about, you know, just sharing my process. And I just came to this realization that I am not a genius.
You're not a what?
And I'm not a genius. And I'm not, you know, I'm not a theological genius. I've studied as much as I can. I've read as much as I can.
Right.
I've tried to understand the history of what I've been at, not as well as my experience, as well as the theology, as well as the scripture. And then not as much as some. I'll say all that in that I'm looking at a whole group of people that are, you know, there are some handicapped people in the front, some really smart people in the middle, you know, some old people in the back and some young people at the front. We're all different, and we cover a myriad of different lives and journeys and intelligence quotients and all of that. And I was at a point where I was like, if I have to be a genius to be able to understand just the basic principle that love is the greatest commandment of all, then I have failed miserably.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like at that point that my wrists and my hands and all of me was bound, just completely tied up. And now I kind of sound like I'm preaching, but at that point I was like, I don't want to be bound. If Christ said that he came so that I have life abundantly, then I'm going to live my life that way. And I'm going to try and be as meek and as kind and as gracious and compassionate through all of those things and continue to endeavor to be the best human being possible. But there's a caveat to, I think, some of the ways that I felt like I was raised up in my Christian faith, that we should do nothing unless we can do it properly. The kind of the whole attitude of, you know, Peter in the boat and Jesus saying to Peter, you know, you can walk on water as well. You just have to get out of the boat and try it. You have to believe that you can do that. And I think that's part of it. I have to believe today that tomorrow that I can still continue to be a person of faith, that despite this ongoing Christian thought that we have that we continue to tear ourselves down because we're not worthy of God, because we're sinful, because we're terrible human beings, and without Christ in between, you know, we're going straight to hell. That tends to be such a negative attitude, rather than flipping that around on its head and going, listen, I am capable of being a good human being, a loving, compassionate, worthwhile human being, and I'm going to move. And I'd rather move and make a mistake and in a sense, move forward with the love and fear and trembling and being still and allowing God to be God. That's where I'm at. And so I'm with you. There are some days I don't believe in God at all. I'm like, how can this be? This is way too much for me. And just getting to a relaxed state about that and going, well, listen, you know, I don't feel like the lightning bolt's going to strike me down on the head because I doubt today. I need to doubt today because if I doubt, then I ask questions that I'm continuing to pursue. It's when I cease to doubt and when I cease to care and when I cease to reckon what this process will be for me that I actually start to get concerned about myself.
I thought you weren't a theologian.
I'm not.
Well, that's pretty C.S. Lewis-y, everything you've just said. There are days, Jennifer, where I get so exhausted from this public search that I'm now, you know, I kind of look back and go, oh, what a meathead. What was I thinking about coming out with my spiritual crisis, right? My crisis of faith. Do you have those kind of days where you just go, oh, I'm just so tired of this being so public and so, and the dialogue and engaging in this all the time. I just want to live life.
And I mean, I think that's part of it, you know, and at the same time, I do feel a responsibility to it. I really, to be honest, I mean, when I started to do music again and started to think about sharing public, you know, just sharing music publicly, because that's kind of the way you do it. And I was really hoping that all I would have to do is just go play my gig and come home. And life isn't like that. I mean, life is about the conversation and what talents you have that you bring to the table and share with other people.
And life, life is about the struggle, too. At least I tend to learn when there's a struggle. When I'm in cruise, I don't learn.
Absolutely. And that's that part of that vulnerability. Like, and for me as a songwriter, that's where I feel like I've learned that lesson very much, is that it's in our vulnerabilities and in our weaknesses and in our willingness to share our fear, not to be ruled by our fear, but to share with others what we're going through in a, hopefully a safe environment, that for me, I've learned so much more about what it takes for other people to be, you know, when I see somebody who's angry, I start to think, no, that guy's just, instead of just thinking that guy's a jerk and he deserves to be punished for his anger, it makes me think now, what got that person to that point? What have I done that's helped that? What can I do to alleviate that?
Yeah.
And I think those are processes that, out of sharing your own vulnerability, I think, to me at least, has only added more abundant life to, like, it only increases my willingness to participate in Christianity and to try and understand what this whole thing's about. It kind of refreshes it in a way for me that I really didn't anticipate. I thought I was going to be in cruise control the day that I figured out, oh, I'm going to be here forever. Whether I'm good at it or bad at it, whether people say I'm a good Christian or a bad Christian, I'm probably going to be a Christian for the rest of my life. Oh, my gosh, what does this mean? and that's the case. And, you know, it is confusing, it is troubling, but I think it's important for us that no matter who we are, what we do, that we are all, in a sense, you know, have that ability to be inspiring to the people around us while we are being vulnerable.
All right, let's finish with this. I talked to a guy yesterday who says that he is crazy about you. Crazy. Like crazy. Are you getting it? Crazy about you.
All right. I have an alarm system on my home.
No, you said that you noticed him as well. He's just enamored with you. And the question is, I mean, you know, you're breaking all these guys' hearts, and Paul Coleman is so sad.
Paul Coleman. Oh, that Aussie bloke.
Yeah, he said that he had a great flight with you and your partner and lunch together at Raleigh Airport, and boy, there's a guy who gets it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you know, I enjoyed running into him. I hadn't seen that guy in years. And we just happened to run into each other at the airport, and I don't know, like, from the whole time, like, we hung out there at the airport, and you know how long that takes.
Yeah.
We happened to be on the same flight into Nashville, and we should actually probably hook up sometime again, but he's an intense and amazing, lovely human being. And talk about a guy who wears his compassion and his life experience on his sleeve.
Yeah, he wears his mess on his sleeve too, you know. So
yeah, he does. And you know what? I mean, he'll tell you. I think Paul will tell you that he realizes that he might very well be driving you nuts. But I think at the same time, he really does challenge me in one of the best ways to realize that we're all like these amazingly lovely, messy, beautiful, wonderful people. And I love that energy. And I would take a guy like him any day of the week over somebody who just looks at me and stares. And, you know, I think he's a guy who really challenges his own faith and challenges to live his life. And it's nice to, like, find people out there that, you know, are a little bit crazier than you.
Yes, that's why we all love Paul, because he makes us feel better about ourselves.
He's a brilliant guy, and I think there are a lot worse examples. And I think one of the things about Christianity that has always been really frustrating to me is that we tend to endorse those who are the finest examples because they've achieved, at least in appearance, the greatness that we, you know, the righteousness or the holiness that we should have in an external way. The more people that I've met in my journeys and in my travels, and it's not always that way. I mean, the appearance isn't always spanking shiny clean. Sometimes those are the dirtiest people behind the scenes, and, it's, you know, I'm not saying that that's always the case, but there are some people who look really rough as guts. And there's another fellow I met. His name is Nathan Lee. He's a Christian tattooed up guy. He's a keyboard player. He kind of looks like he's Bruce Springsteen bringing the rock and roll New Jersey kind of guy. And I tell you what, I mean, I was stunned by this guy that the first time I ever met him, I really felt like I was in the presence of somebody who understood what compassion and grace was, even though his language might not reflect it, or he didn't have like the Christian language in everything that he was saying. He didn't have the trite turns of phrases. He didn't have, you know, the catchy little sayings that made me recognize instantly that he was a person of faith, or that he believed in God or Christianity or anything. Mm. But as we got to talking, I realized this man is, if I was half the person of faith and of compassion and of kindness and gentleness as this guy was in that meeting that I had with him, I'd have loved it. You know, I would have felt like I've accomplished much in my life. And so, I think, you know, we put a lot on the external appearance, but it has a lot to do with what we're willing to go for and the depths that we're willing to plumb to get there.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly get the impression that you were never really all that comfortable of a fit with the church folks right from the start. And since then, you know, maybe you felt alienated by the dysfunction of Christendom. And I don't think that's such a bad thing, actually. So I look forward to sitting down and having a big old bowl of mashed potatoes and smothered in gravy with you one of these days.
We'll see how much of this chair you get.
Oh, fine. Jennifer, you're the bomb. My kids tell me that if I say that, it makes me look cool. I don't think it's working, but I'll still say it.
Nice try, mate.
Yeah, nice try. Thank you very much, Jennifer. I wish you the best. I really do. And if you need somebody to take out somebody, you know, mess with them, slash their tires, key their car, Paul Coleman is your guy.
All right. He's a local, so.
Good to talk with you, Jen.
Thanks a lot, Drew. I really appreciate it.
Take care.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye-bye. Jennifer Knapp, what a story, what a journey, what a life, what a talent. Have a listen, jenniferknapp.com. When we come back, Lila Bialy in the house, ladies and gentlemen. Whew. We've got a lot of talent on the show today.
It's great.
And Tim's here too. We'll be right back.